My name is Dick Swanson, and the, I'll sing. The title of this session tonight is Heartways, Shaman, New Calling of the Saints. But before we get into that, what has happened at the beginning of each of our sessions is that we have had a very brief practice of what I call practicing the present. And by present, I mean present in two ways. I mean the present moment of life, which is life, that present moment where we come face to face with the God who says, my name is I am, not I was or I will be, but I am. And also present in the sense that this moment, this now, is a gift. And it is an eternally gracious gift. It has come from the beginning, and it will go until the ending. And there is nothing that we do to merit it. It comes as utter gift. And the way I find best in coming into that present is simply to take a brief period of time and become awake to, attentive to, or aware of our breathing. It may seem like such a simple thing, but breathing is one of the only things that we do always in the present. We do not breathe with our minds. We breathe very naturally, and as we breathe, the Spirit of God flows in and out of our very being, and always our breathing is now. We're not talking about anything that's magical. I'm not suggesting that you go into this breathing exercise looking for something. I'm suggesting that we simply be aware of our breathing. And in the process, because we are human, we will also be aware of the fact that we are aware of our breathing. We'll be thinking about our breathing, and maybe more layers than that. And when you find that happening, when you discover in this brief period of time a thought coming in, a physical sensation, a particular feeling, a psychic or psychological feeling, just simply be aware of that. Don't fight it. Don't say, I must be doing something wrong because I'm not paying attention to my breathing. Just note whatever it is that comes. You may find it helpful to just say, thank you, God, for thought. Thank you, God, for feeling. Thank you, God, for fear or whatever, and simply continue with your breathing. Imagine, if you will, that you are a video camera and you are watching your breathing. Or imagine that you are, if you will, the mountain, Buckskin, directly above us, watching the wind of God flow by today with the clouds. If that helps, try that. But we're going to do this for 5 minutes, and I ask only this, not that you have to participate, because you may not be comfortable with this. You may not have done this before. You may have some anxiety about it. You may wonder what sorts of things we're involved in. If that's the case, I'd say just relax, but do one thing together with everyone else, and that is to close your eyes so that nobody is being watched. And the watching I will do of the clock will be done with my eyes down, and I will not be looking at you even if my eyes are open. So you will be unobserved as you engage in this exercise. So if you will begin by wiggling around enough to find that spot in the chair that you feel you can sit in relatively comfortably for 5 minutes. Don't worry about where your hands are or how your feet are or whether your legs are crossed or anything like that. Just sit very comfortably, relaxed, quiet, and close your eyes. And as you do that, notice how many sensations are still there. Your eyes are closed. And begin now to simply pay attention to your breathing. And we'll do this for 5 minutes. And at the end of 5 minutes, we'll come back. Simply watch the breath of life enter and depart, come in and come out. Don't change your breathing pattern. Don't try to breathe deeply or exhale deeply. Just breathe as you breathe and watch your breathing, feel your breathing, and whenever you become aware of anything else, just acknowledge it and come back to your breathing. The awareness of your breathing begin to fade. And when they are ready, your eyes will open by themselves. Oh, there are chairs up here, lots of them. Might be more comfortable sitting in a chair. Please feel free. We've got a little break point here. So, how did you find that period of time being aware of your breathing? how fully would you say you were aware of your breathing? How much were you aware of other things? What was your experience?
Well, I was aware of my breathing. I was very relaxed. And I had other thoughts that came through my mind. But then I kept concentrating on the breathing. I felt good. I felt kind of at peace.
Okay. Anyone else?
As I got more relaxed, I found it harder to rely on concentrate on the breathing.
Okay. What were you aware of? Without being specific, I mean.
Not a whole lot, actually. More like slipping into a dream type of sleep.
Okay. Yes, Karen?
I went to Holden Lake today, and so I could feel my breathing a lot easier today than last time I was at one of your lectures, because my air passages have all been opened up today, and so I could feel it. Like breathing cold air. It felt like breathing cold air. It was lovely.
Anyone else? What was your experience with your breathing?
I was real aware of all the distractions.
All right.
So much. For some reason, I had a lot of trouble focusing.
All right. One of the beautiful things about this room and this building is that there are a variety of sounds. It's not soundproof. Sound travels through. Imagine the problem that we have with silence in worship. Some people say, and this is repetition, but it's a very important thing to keep repeating in this series of spirituality exercises. Some people say we want more silence in worship. But we can't do that because there are little children making noises. There are people coming and going. There is not a time or an opportunity for real silence. In order to do that, you've got to go into a closet somewhere, into a darkened room, and get away from all of the distractions. But the silence that is necessary for worship is the silencing of that within which makes judgments and would make things go away, whether it's people, the stranger, the hungry person, make go away the noise, make go away anything that is supposedly an interruption. Because life is not the absence of interruption. Life is interruption. It always is. So what we learn in focusing on our breathing for even short periods of time, like 5 minutes, is that there is a continual stream of things that come in. It's almost like a symphony of sound, of sight, of memory, of hope, of fear, of physical sensation. It just keeps coming. And what we try to do is to make it all go away so that we can be silent. And silence means silencing that within us which wants to make everything go away. That's why in the practice or in being silent in church or being in the presence of God, it does not depend on an absence of sound, which is really an absence of life, but it really depends on an absence of that within us which judges, which says, this is good and this is bad, this should be, this shouldn't be, and so forth. That's the purpose of that little 5-minute practice. It is so that when we are washing the dishes, we can wash the dishes amid all the distractions. And not wash the dishes in order to get to the other side of washing the dishes, which might be watching television. When washing the dishes, wash the dishes. When watching the breathing, watch the breathing. And whatever comes, to simply welcome it and continue to focus on the particular task. Shaman. New calling of the saints. What is a shaman? It's first of all a word that we don't typically use. Jeff, do you want to say what a shaman is?
Before state level, before tribal level, the band level society, the shaman is sort of a religious person, before a priest, or like, maybe more like a medicine man.
Very good. It goes back many, many centuries, in fact, several millennia in human history. It really goes back into Northern Asia. It's S-H-A-M-A-N, shaman. A shaman was a person who almost invariably had some kind of physical abnormality. Whenever a child was born in those places where the shaman was common, and incidentally, shamans continue today in several cultures in the world. But whenever a child was born, it would immediately be inspected. How many fingers? 10. Toes? 10. Any evidence of facial irregularities? Any marks on the body and so on and so forth? Because when there was an irregularity, it was a sign that this person was preordained by the spirits even before birth in the womb of the mother to become a shaman. And were the person to resist that as the life developed and the person went through adolescence, the social structure would continue to press in on the individual that this individual had no choice. It could often be an epileptic person because they would exhibit, as they developed, the seizures. And these were seen to be times when the person was in communication with the spirits. And so they were considered very sacred. And an epileptic person coming out of a seizure was listened to very carefully to hear what that person would have to say about the spirit world with which that person had been communicating. Thus became the shaman. You know, I don't like to have to admit this, but at Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois, the Jesus in the Ascension window above Ascension Chapel has 6 toes on his right foot. It's a fact. I sat there a number of years ago and I was looking at that. I was looking at Jesus' feet. And I don't know what compelled me to count his toes. Maybe it was not being aware of my breathing. But I did. And he has 6 toes on his right foot. Well, it didn't take long to find out because the college is a place with answers. And so a very learned historian came and said, well, you see, in the Renaissance, it was considered very important to show that Jesus wasn't quite human. And so they might add a little abnormality in the portrayal. And so, pop, out came a 6th toe on the Jesus. I call it the 6th-toed Jesus window. And some people don't like that. But that person would become a shaman. And then throughout that person's life, that person's responsibility to the tribe was to share what he, because most shamans then were male, but not all, to share what he or she knew. The literal translation of the word shaman is one who knows. And that is what saints today are called to be. Shaman in that sense, the people who know. A neat little line about shaman is one who brings to language the story of the earth. One who knows the story of the earth. One who knows the story of creation. One who knows the myth. This morning, somebody obviously had asked Michael Wuchter, what do you mean when you're talking about myth? And I really felt for him, because the question often comes from our belief that myth is something which is nonsensical or doesn't have root in reality. But a myth is that which we as a people know and live by. And we know some things as a Christian people. We have our Christian myths, and now you see myth becomes okay. We know that Jesus of Nazareth is God's Son. We know that. That is part of our myth, if you will. It is that which we know and by which our lives work. But the problem in our time, posed by the question, is not a fear that there might be a myth. The problem in our time, in our civilization, as we come to the end of the 20th century, is that we ain't got no myth anymore. We don't have something which we collectively know, because the big myth is not the Christian myth. The big myth that we've been living by is the industrial technological myth, that we are the people who essentially own the cosmos and can do with it as we please, and surely we will do well by it. We can use it for our purposes, and it will continue to sustain us to the end of time. And already we know it don't work. Because that myth is dying. All that has to happen for a myth to die is for one little child in the crowd to say, "Hey, the emperor ain't got no clothes on." And they're popping up all over our time in history, people who are pointing out that the whole industrial technological myth that our brilliance and our manipulation of all that is will save us ain't got no clothes on. So what we need is not to shake away all the myths, which is what a lot of Christians want to do. We need a new myth. But myths do not come quickly. A couple of times tonight, I'm going to refer to that PBS television series in which Bill Moyers interviewed Joseph Campbell before he died. And it came to be called The Power of Myth. And in that, and it's also a book for 1990, which translates into Washington, State of Washington language 2145. It's over in the bookstore. It looks like this. It's a wonderful book. Power of Myth. It's a dark cover. You can't read it. The Power of Myth. And one of the nights that we were here, since we've been here, Chuck Lutz, our village philosopher, was having a conversation with some people about inclusive language. And the problem with our inclusive language is not that we are incapable of saying mother as well as father when we address God. The real problem and the tension in which we live is that those metaphors, mother, father, have not yet become myth. So that it becomes that which we as a people know and operate by. And it's going to take a while to do that. And it's going to take that kind of intentional myth building in the church so that we are able to look at God, our Creator, and see what we've always seen in our own human story, both a mother and a father. We have no other conception of how we came to be as human beings than a mother and a father. And it is us who will have to build up that myth so that it works and people can see that the very ground of their being is both mother and father. Yes?
But do you think that a myth is something that can be created intellectually? Or isn't it just kind of something that comes...
I believe that a myth is created when there is a deep cooperation between those of us who are human in the earth and the earth itself. The wholeness of life has to come together and there has to be a deep communication. It requires a shaman. It requires shamans who are able in their freedom and in their understanding of themselves to move deeply and freely within all that is and tell the stories. Does that help? We don't just create it. We don't set out to say we have a committee on myth making.
Well,
it doesn't work. Go ahead.
It's like you were saying we needed to change the myth from father to father and mother.
We need to expand the myth in that regard.
But how do you know that?
How do I know that? I know that because it's becoming increasingly consistent with all of the ways in which I experience life. I have no experience of life whatsoever that has only a male origin. Do you?
No.
Okay, that's how I know it, I guess. And that's the best answer that I can give you. Your question is probing, and it is terribly important that it be asked. We're not just trying to manipulate people. We're not trying to be clever. But we are the people who know something, and that is that we are the children of God, from which all comes, male and female. So I don't want to press any further on this particular point because the mother-father thing is only one part of what we're concerned about in the myth. What I'd like to suggest to you in whether it's the hours you have left at Holden, as I and my mother and Anna and Chuck and Hertha and so forth, all who are leaving tomorrow, or whether you are here as long-term staff or whether you've just arrived as guests and have more time and so forth, what I'd like to suggest to you tonight is that Holden, it seems to me, is a place which is almost subversively, in a wonderful way, producing shamans. Holden is a place where part of the myth is being created. Holden is a myth-making community. And what do I see? And then I'm going to ask you, what do you see here at Holden? What I see at Holden is a place which is coming increasingly to see that all of life is one. That there is a oneness between us here and the tailings and the deer and the chipmunk and the mountains and the clouds and the water and the air and so forth. And Holden is a place that is reminding us of all those linkages as we deal with garbology and as we eat in new ways, which has less impact on the resources of the earth. Holden is trying to live lightly on the land because it knows that we are one and we can't trample the land. But we can live in the land and with the land. That's one of the things that Holden is doing in terms of creating a new myth and sustaining that. What do you see? What do you see going on here at Holden? Victor?
You know, what I see here is what's going on is what's supposed to be going on. Not without trying to describe all the philosophy, but what people are doing here just feels so right. It's like it's what's supposed to be happening. If I'm walking up the mountain, it's because I'm supposed to be there. Not because it's good exercise or because it gives me a communion with nature, but it's a whole... a holistic sort of a thing. This is what I should be doing.
Makes you feel like you're at home?
Yeah, it makes me feel, and the village makes me feel that way too, and the people in the village. It's not a sense of we should be striving for this. We're doing it because we should be doing it. It's what's right for right now.
What else do you see? Thank you. Yes.
If in fact Holden here is where we're producing the shamans, then we better shut down a bunch of the Lutheran seminaries and reduce the number of people we crank out and have them tag up here a while.
As a former member...
As a way to sort of get the church going in the right direction.
In Chuck Lutz's book, Surprising Gift, the story of Holden Village Church Renewal Center, or something like that, subtitle, that's what's going on here, that church renewal. And I can tell you this, it's Bill, right? Bill, I guess, the immediate past chairperson of the Academic Affairs Committee at Lutheran School of Theology at Chicago, and it isn't that I'd like to have all of LSTC come out here because that'd be way too many people, and besides, they're used to living in Chicago and they never find their way around here. But what I'd like to see is for that which is flowing out of here as though it were on Railroad Creek and into Lake Chelan and into the whole atmosphere, that it would flow into there and Luther Northwestern, into Gettysburg and into Philadelphia, Lutheran School of Theology at Philadelphia, Pacific Lutheran Theological School, and so on and so forth. I'd like to see the seminaries produce more shamans, and in many ways they are. I don't despair. I think there are some real storytellers going on there, and there are people in those seminaries who know and are themselves kind of shamans. I'll tell you one at LSTC is a fellow by the name of Phil Hefner, who is putting together a whole new center for the study of faith and science, which is an ecological kind of thing. Anyone else?
I've heard of him. I am finding that I'm experiencing awareness of things that I was never even thought of before.
How's that happening to you here?
I don't know, but just being with the group of people and so varied and so many new ideas and so many new people. I feel like I'm constantly being hit by all sorts of things in a good way.
Luigi, thank you.
One of the things that set the shamans apart was experience. It was an experiential setting apart. And that's what happens to people here at Holden, is various types of experiences and on various levels, a kind of vision quest for some people. But the shamans live with other people who have not had those experiences. And the thing that I see here that I think is important to remember is that the shamans go back down the mountain and be with the people who have not had those experiences.
What parallel strikes you there, going back down the mountain? The transfiguration, right? Thank you. Anna?
I feel at Holden like I'm becoming a part of everything, the mountain and the all of creation that's here and the people. And so as Luigi was saying, to take that back down the mountain again will be very easy because it's all together, all in one piece.
Okay.
I find that, at least for me, it's almost like a utopia here, and maybe we're creating shamans and getting that kind of idea building going and getting people thinking in the directions of that because they don't have to worry about crime or unemployment because everybody's unemployed here. Or a lot of the things that you have to worry about in everyday life just aren't even a consideration here. Nobody locks anything, and you have time and everybody has the same interests involved in this.
Thank you. Holden, in an age now that we understand as an age of quantum theory, where every single particle is intimately and necessarily and forever related to every single other particle in all of creation, Holden has no meaning at all apart from the whole rest of the world. And another way to look at it is an Eastern way, and that is to say, Holden has no secret. And nothing that comes out of Holden can be kept secret. There are no secrets. And we come to a place like this and we say, aha, I know. And it wasn't that we thought it up. It wasn't that Holden thought it up. It becomes a place where we know what we know and we take it with us, always. Let me suggest another dimension of Holden's shaman building. But I want to do it with a couple of stories, one out of my own life and one out of Anthony DeMello. Anthony DeMello has been a part of what I've been doing. He died in 1987, a Jesuit priest from Pune, India, has become truly, in both life and death, one of the great spiritual masters of our time. I'd like to read to you a story from his story book called Taking Flight. The master was in an expansive mood, so his disciples sought to learn from him now the stages he had passed through in his quest for the divine. God first led me by the hand, he said, into the land of action, and there I dwelt for several years. Then God returned and led me to the land of sorrow. There I lived until my heart was purged of every inordinate attachment. That is when I found myself in the land of love, whose burning flames consumed whatever was left in me of self. This brought me to the land of silence, where the mysteries of life and death were bared before my wondering eyes. Was that the final stage of your quest? The disciples asked. No, the master said. One day, God said, today I shall take you to the innermost sanctuary of the temple, to the heart of God. And I was led to the land of laughter. Holden has a phrase. It is perhaps one of the most dangerous phrases here, but it is holy hilarity. It's dangerous because it can intimidate people. It's dangerous because it can make people feel that they have to be hilarious. But once you are freed of that, you're free then to laugh. Now the story out of my own experience. Christmas Eve, the first year that I went with my then fiancé, who is up here with me now, and next month it's 35 years, the first Christmas Eve that we were together in her home. And we're all gathered around the dining room table and the plates are all set and so forth. And on each plate is a glass of wine. Now, I've had wine before this particular night, but never in my life had I been asked to say a table prayer when all there was in sight was a glass of wine. We're talking 1953, I think, Christmas Eve. And something that in me must have looked strange, because my wife's aunt, who just died a couple of weeks ago while we were over in Sweden, my wife's aunt sat there, and she had already tasted the fruit of the vine that night and was just snuffing out her unfiltered cool. And she said in a sort of raucous, raspy voice, she says, "Oh, what the hell, Swanee? It's all in fun anyway." And you know what? If we are the people who are justified by faith, if we are the people whose works are the expression of our being saved rather than the avenue to being saved, it is all in fun anyway. And I'm glad I had a chance this last year before she died to say, "Hey, Ellen, do you remember the night you told me that it was all in fun anyway?" And there she was at age 82 and just withering away, and she just dropped below the 100-pound mark, and she laughed again and butted out her unfiltered cool and set aside her can of red, white, and blue and laughed again, and she says, "Yeah, I sure do. It's all in fun." Shamans know that. They know it in a way that doesn't make it disrespectful, but that at the heart of life, the life that is given, the life that is most deeply rooted in God, there is at the bottom of it all a good laugh. A good laugh. The holy laughter of Easter. You know, we're always being taught that around Easter time, that the Easter hymns, like "La la 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 la," were all laughter hymns. "Jesus Christ is risen today, ha 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 ha." Laughing at death and laughing at Satan. That's exactly what they were. Well, think of the material Holden has to work with. This is before we're going to go back and do another little exercise. Think of the material. Do you realize who we are? Do you realize the myth that we bring with us, and we live by it, and it becomes a part of our very heart? And it's a myth that may, God be pleased, we never lose. Think about it. We are people whose unique identity is based on the fact that some water was placed on us, or we were placed in the water at some point in our lives. You want to talk about some weird things? How does that give identity? But it does, doesn't it? We are marked out as daughters and sons of God through that action. We are people who drink a little bit of wine and eat a little bit of bread and know deeply within us, because it is our working myth, that which we know and by which we live, that in, with, and under that bread and wine we have had the body and blood of Jesus Christ. You want to talk about a weird people ready to be shamans? We are people who are able to sit quietly or to speak aloud and address ourselves to the absolute origin of all that is, as though that one was you, Mother, right here. You want to talk about a weird people? I mean, we are ready to be shamans. We are the best working material that any shaman factory could ever hope to have come up the valley. Couple of other little stories. Here's something that we really all know, and maybe in a way Holden encourages this, because all of the activity, you know, the putting together of 4th of July's and the putting together of Vespers and the putting together of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dream Coat and all that kind of thing. Again, Anthony DeMello, little storybook, 1 Minute Wisdom. Someone comes to the master and says, and DeMello always uses the term master, What action shall I perform to attain God? The master says, if you wish to attain God, there are two things you must know. The first is that all efforts to attain God are to no avail. Well then, what is the second? You must act as if you did not know the first. So that's why at Holden, as the miner said on the 4th of July, we do, we undo, we redo what we do, because, and that's what we're doing all of the time. In our doing, we're acting out as though we didn't know the truth that we don't have to act out. And then beneath it all, what did we just do? We laugh. That's the heart of Holden's holy hilarity. Another little story. What does it mean to do these kind of little exercises at Holden? Someone comes to the master and says, is there anything I can do to make myself enlightened? And the master says, as little as you can do to make the sun rise in the morning. Well, then of what use are the spiritual exercises you prescribe? Well, to make sure you're not asleep when the sun rises. So what Holden is doing, in all of its various ways, is sort of keeping us awake even when we sleep, which is to say, awake to our dreams. Because myth comes out of our dreams, too. You know, I don't know if we're yet dreaming God as mother, but I would say that when the time comes that men and women are able to say that they dream God as mother, the myth will be taking root, you see. That'll be a sign. Well, the stories are very brief. Why do we spend time in our hearts? What does that have to do with that whole world out there? Isn't it a place where we'll just sort of fall asleep and not experience anything other than ourselves? The master became a legend in his lifetime, and it was said that God once sought the master's advice. I want to play a game of hide and seek with humankind. I've asked my angels what the best place to hide in. Some say the depth of the ocean, others the top of the highest mountain, others still the far side of the moon or a distant star. What do you suggest? Said the master, hide in the human heart. That's the last place they'll think of. And I'll stop the DeMello stories with something which is deep mystery and part of the myth that we're building here. Said the master, there are three stages in one's spiritual development: the carnal, the spiritual, and the divine. What is the carnal stage? Asked the eager disciples. That's the stage when trees are seen as trees and mountains are seen as mountains. And the spiritual? That's when one looks more deeply into things. Then trees are no longer trees and mountains no longer mountains. And the divine? Ah, said the master, that's enlightenment. That's when trees become trees again, and mountains become mountains again. That's what the shaman knows. The shaman knows that the trees are really trees, and we know that the bread is really bread, and that the wine is really wine, and we also know something more. If I had a chance to come back to Holden Village again, I suppose the story I'm about to tell you would suggest that I ought to come back again as a teacher. But no, I think I'd like to come back and just work either as a maverick or as a garbologist, or I think as a waitry. Because of this, once there was a person who was a gardener. And this person's task in the garden was to hoe in the garden all day. But one day, deeply frustrated, looking for the meaning of life. The person threw down the hoe and rushed to the nearest village and to the wise person in the village and said, "Wise person, please tell me the meaning of life." And the wise person said, "I can't." But the gardener was on a quest and went to the next village and the wise person there and said, "Wise person, tell me the meaning of life." And the wise person said, "I can't." But this was no ordinary gardener, easily put off. And the gardener went to every village and every wise person in the world until the gardener came to the last village and the last wise person and said, "Wise person, tell me the meaning of life." And the wise person said, "I can't." And so the gardener, with a very heavy heart, went back home and went into the garden and picked up the hoe and began to hoe and struck a rock and threw down the hoe and rushed back to the first village and the first wise person. And before the gardener could say a word, the wise person said, "Aha, now you see." Joseph Campbell was asked by Bill Moyers, "What do you think people are looking for?" Joseph Campbell, by the way, was one of the great scholars of all time in all of the myths, the wonderful myths of the world. "What do you think people are looking for?" Moyers said. "Aren't they looking for meaning in life?" And Joseph Campbell said, "No. They're not looking for meaning. People want to experience life." Which is a neat little spin on the story of the gardener. The gardener, in looking for the meaning of life, discovered that you don't find that. What you do is you experience life. And here at Holden, it becomes so important as part of this community to experience life. Not just to sit and think about it. Not to sit inside rooms like this, which are barely lighted, when there are mountains and sunsets and so forth going on around us, but to be here in this place and instead of pursuing the meaning of life, to experience life, out of which meaning comes. I'd like to try a little experience. And what I'd like to do is to have you enter into your heart and travel in your heart far enough away, and we'll sort of lead the way, far enough away so that you can look back and see this place and know the myth that has to emerge. So if you'll just wiggle around, this is not going to be long. It's about 7:41. We're going to be out of here very shortly. You just wiggle around so that you're in a place where you can be comfortable for just a couple of minutes and then close your eyes. Whether or not you're going to participate or not, just close your eyes. And begin to become aware of your breathing. That's a way of coming into the present, and it's also a way of receiving the present. The gift of life, the spirit. And become aware of the sounds of Paul lecturing in the next room, the sound of Railroad Creek, the other sounds of this building, the patterns of light and shadow that cross our closed eyes, our bodies seated, our breathing, voices. And with your breathing now, follow your breathing upward. Follow your breathing as something which is continually rising. Rise with your breathing until you're at least at the top of this room and you look at us sitting here. Look at yourself. Look at all of us together. People. women and men, children of God. But notice that your breathing has wonderful qualities, magical qualities, and by following it you move straight through the roof. And you go up high enough to just look at the village. And you see the deer, you see the children, the adults, the people coming and going. You see those who are anxiously preparing for Vesper and anxiously preparing for the amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. You see the people who are resting and aren't particularly anxious about everything. And you follow your breathing still higher. And now you're above the tailings and you look down and you see the tailings for what they are. Gifts of God, which we don't understand and which we fear, but gifts of God. Tailings that some here have experienced as wanting to love us, but always coming up against our resistance to being loved by the polluted surface of the earth. And then higher, rising with your breathing, as though your breathing was a balloon, and you rise now and you're up about the height of Buckskin and Copper and Dumbbell Mountains. And you look down and you begin to see the shape of Railroad Creek, the long glaciated slash that leads to Lake Chelan. And as you go higher, you begin to see Lake Chelan. And as you go higher, Mount Rainier comes in. And as you go higher, you see the configuration of the Pacific Northwest, the Sound, the Straits, the western edge of our western hemisphere, higher until you see the curvature of the earth, and you begin to see the horizons beyond which are sun and moon and stars and all the spaces. And now your breath is taking on great power and taking you higher and higher, yet always with you so that you're not gasping for breath. High enough up so that you look back and you see the beautiful blue, green home. The home of homes. The place of Jesus. The place of the saints and shamans. Our source, our mother, our father, our sister, our brother, our lover, our origin and our destiny. With all that is, all that ever was, and all that ever will be, with all of creation. And listen to the mountains and the deep places, the sea monsters and the rain and the snow, the clouds and the wind, fire, sun and moon and all stars, together with the earth, simply breathing with us and breathing, praise God, from whom all blessings flow. And then, like a feather gently floating down, watch yourself come back down, ever so gently and yet ever so quickly. Until you alight in this place. And when you are ready, remember your breathing one last time in this exercise. and as our eyes open. Remember what we know. What happens to shamans? Said one to the teacher, "I wish to become a teacher of the truth." Said the master, "Are you prepared to be ridiculed, ignored, and starving until you are at least 45 years old?" "I am, but tell me, what will happen after I'm 45? "You will have grown accustomed to it." Thank you all.